Welcome back to Dating Games, the Modern Relationships Podcast. I'm your host, Bobby Temps, and this week's comedian guest has quickly made a name for himself with a chatty presence and distinct writing style. You may know him from the many BBC Three comedy shorts he's been in, or one of the crazy number of Instagram sketches he's been filming since lockdown one. Now, having waited a year, he's the latest person to shave his head in lockdown. It's Patrick Spicer.
Hello, thank you. I am the latest person to shave my head.
And you
That's what I'm famous for.
And you were so close, you know? You've got, what is it now, a month? A month and
it's
a bit?
It's a month from now, but I shaved it a month ago. And at that point, it was already looking pretty ridiculous. So it was, I almost made it to the finish line.
I timed it well because I was already growing my hair. And now it's just a game of like, oh, how long can it grow? How mountainy can I get as a man before this?
Is your hair long? Because I can't actually see on the Zoom. Is that a ponytail?
You've got a
bun.
Oh, it's all carefully hidden away. Yeah, it's actually down to like here.
All right. For the listener, Bobby is gesturing to just above his nipples.
Mm, yeah. That's what I'm aiming for. Gotta hide them away.
Nipple length. Yeah, it's like when people do the bowl cuts and they put a bowl over their head, whereas you put one that stretches down to the nipples and then you cut all the way around your body.
And to be fair, you know, one of the perks of being Irish and having like bushy, kind of wiry hair, it's relatively waterproof. So maybe that's it. Maybe if I get really stuck and this lockdown goes on forever, I just fashion it into its own umbrella.
Mm. I like that for you.
Not that we're going anywhere, but you know.
No, yeah, unless it's raining inside your flat, you probably don't really need to worry about that. If you have a bad leak, yeah. You can do like a sear and just spread it straight out.
Mm. This is not relevant to the listeners, and please don't worry about me, but we've recently been dealing with the fun realization that we are in one of the tower blocks with Grenfell-style cladding.
Grenfell-style cladding.
It's not an exact replica, but it's near enough that we should be worried. And somebody recently had a fire in their apartment, and I don't know what it was. It was probably like their toaster caught on fire, but the whole building got evacuated at 7 a.m. because we're taking it very seriously.
Do you have those like fire patrolmen who are like walking around the building spotting for fires?
We do, yeah.
Oh my God. How many stories?
I am on the 9th floor. It goes up to 13.
No, I meant how many stories do you have about the patrolman?
I don't
know. That was a joke. Did you like it?
It's brilliant. Well, you know what? Believe it or not, I have a story to go with that. So I, for a long time, was like instinctively distrustful of security people because of a lot of going out as a younger guy, as somebody that doesn't drink. And they all want to know why. They all have questions. They all want to see my ID. Like, they think it's a whole conspiracy. And so it's kind of made me a bit like, ugh, do we have to do this every time I want to go to a club? So yeah, I don't talk to them. My flatmate knows all their names. She's very involved.
That's such a wholesome reason to have an aversion to security. It's because you don't drink, so they suspect you of being like too good, as opposed to someone who always gets into fights with security or gets too drunk and rowdy. You're just like, my main problem with security is that I'm too much of a good boy, and then you buy it.
That's a fun way of thinking about it, actually. But you could also look at it as, why don't they trust me? What is it they're seeing in me where they're like, no, you've got a problem that this isn't normal.
Oh, I see. Yeah. And do you partake in substances? Is that a guilty conscience?
No, but another guest recently really is working to convert me to CBD oil. So I am doing my research.
Mm, yeah, see, I'd love to do CBD because my girlfriend was talking about that the other day. I'm terrified of drugs, like in every... So I took ecstasy when I was 13. And like had a 1 million panic attacks and then never stopped having panic attacks. So I never, every time I was like around drugs as a teenager or like even now, it just really spikes anxiety. So I've never been able to get near them, which is really annoying because now in like 2021, it's all like, oh yeah, man, you got to try CBD. And like, we're just microdosing and oh yeah, it's mushrooms. You got to try some. It's like, but then also you got this wall of anxiety in between. If you can only get over it, like I think about mushrooms all the time. I'm like, because maybe you'll come out fixed, or maybe you'll come out more broken than you've ever been before, and that's.
Or maybe you'll have mushrooms, and then you'll think about them even more than you currently do.
Yeah, that's the thing. Could go wrong.
Yeah, I have something a bit similar, actually, where I have enough mental illnesses where I think, is it worth it for another one? No.
Yeah.
I'm good.
Yeah, yeah.
CBD, supposedly, very little risk there, as long as you get decent stuff. But yeah.
CBD is so not dangerous. Like, you walk past the pharmacy and it's like, where all grandmas go, you just walk past all old people going in, and then in like massive posters being like, try CBD oil, it's just got like a massive leaf. It's like, well, I'm sure there's like, if it's safe for grandmas, it's safe for me. Like, I don't see any grandmas getting absolutely rolling off their head on CBD and being like, I got this just next to the Holland and Barrett selection of magnesium and calcium. Like, if those are the same bucket, anything you can get in a, although I guess the principle of anything you can do in a pharmacy can't hurt me is probably a bad one and could be quickly disproven.
Oh yeah, you can overdose on pretty much anything. That's something I learned from a young age, and it has occupied my thoughts more than is normal. Like, years of me going to my parents and being like, even apples? What about bananas? What about grapes? I don't know why they were all fruits, but I think it was a long-running conspiracy to be like, well, you know, you say I should have an apple a day, but what if I accidentally have five and then die?
Right. That sounds like anxiety. That's some nice, that's healthy. Even the apple is going to kill you.
I think
five, you're all right. I think you're getting into territory of like 200 or 300.
Yeah.
Then there's the arsenic. You're the same as me at school. You had one person once say there's arsenic in apples, and then it's like, I will never eat an apple.
You know what? This is maybe the time when I don't have a wholesome reason. I think it was just me trying to get out of fruit. I once held up a whole English lesson because I was more interested in debating whether or not I needed English than I was in learning it. And that is partly dyslexia. But the irony does not escape me that I was arguing in English that I didn't need English.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't understand how that relates to apples.
I don't understand how any of this relates to dating, which is what we're meant to be talking about.
That's true. Sorry.
We're just instead going to delve into all the parts of my childhood I still remember, and apparently it's just stupid stories, nothing real.
Yeah.
So you hopefully have had plenty of time to think of a dating story for us.
Yeah, I've just been stalling for time this entire, all this Apple chat is just me. I frantically, you can see me on Zoom, it's just my pen raring across the pad trying to think of things. Yeah, I don't know, because I don't have loads of dating stories, but I thought I'd tell this story. When I was 15, that was the age when like all of my friends were, everyone was losing their virginities or had lost it, or they were about to lose it, or they were in relationships. And I hadn't. So I went on a ski trip with my family and like some family friends and stuff, this like group of people. And I ended up making out with this girl in this club when I'd been drinking, which was really unusual for me as well at the time, because I wasn't really drinking. I didn't go to clubs because I was 15, but I was obsessed with this idea of like, like, what's that movie where they all have to lose their virginity? American Pie. I was like, I've got to lose my virginity. I was like, I have to come home. Because in my head, all my friends were like these insane, like Don Draper Lotharios. Like, everyone is having loads. I didn't realize at the time, like, everyone was either making it up or they hadn't either. It was like, it was just this perception you get as like a teenage boy of like this obsession. So I ended up making up with this girl. And then on the way back to our chalet, because we're middle class,
I got that from the skiing, don't worry.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I was 15 and there I was on a ski trip. I realized it was time to get laid. So we ended up making out, and then we were like making out in this stairwell and things were like heading towards having sex. And then I couldn't have sex because I was 15, I was terrified, and I was drunk. And I'd never had like any sexual activity really before then, or any potential of having sex. So basically failed to have sex, did not have sex. She was very frustrated, as I'm sure, I don't blame her for that. She went into it expecting something positive, did not have sex, but went back to London and then just told everybody I had had sex. And it was like, to me, that was the smartest thing in the world to do, because then it was just like, I never had to answer that question again. To all of my friends, I was like, oh yeah, I just had sex on holiday. And she went to she was from a totally different part of London, so there was no way that any of my friends could find out. So then from then on, I just became like a sex guy, and then I never had to prove it to anybody else, and I continue just being terrified of sex.
And it's been a lie ever since. Yeah. I mean, is anything real? Do you really have a girlfriend? A sheer cardboard cutout that even you don't sleep with that for fear of the paper cuts?
That's basically it. You've hit the nail on the head there. She's a paper lady. And a lot of people think that they've met her, but actually I'm just incredibly skilled at origami.
I love that. Here's the thing, like, obviously it's bullshit. I hate that whole like virginity pressurizing nonsense. I mean, I'm not a fan of peer pressure across the board, really, which is handy because I'm relatively immune to it.
You're immune to peer pressure?
It's been said. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, I'm Irish and I don't drink. Like, people have tried, you know?
Yeah.
But I've got to the age now where people were worried about me when I was younger. How could I be a child and not be drinking yet? And then when I reached legal age, then they just assume I'm an alcoholic. And now I get less pressure as an adult than I did as a child. Unpack that.
Mm. So you're lucky because I have the Irish influence that as soon as I could start drinking, I did a lot. And then over time developed a drinking problem. And now I'm sober. And I don't have to explain that, but I did go through the process of the normal Irish path of, and now pretty much everyone in my family still drinks pretty heavily, but I don't have the like childhood and teenage era of being like, oh, I'm just the person who doesn't drink.
Yeah, I think maybe I should amend that. I'm perhaps more stubborn than I am immune to peer pressure. That's really what it is. Mm. But it's worked out and I have a perfectly good time without it. Where were we going with this? So many tangents already
so
today.
So I was talking about not having sex when I was 15.
I had a friend that had a slightly less good plan in that, you know, definitely that kind of pressure was around for me growing up as well. And he realised that technically losing your virginity, you just had to kind of get it in once, right? Mm-hmm. So he had issues getting it up because of nerves on his first time, but he managed to kind of push a semi-hard thing enough that it technically counted, and he just counted that. Mm-hmm. He needn't have bothered. He could have just done what you did, just lie.
Yeah, there's no paper trail. That's the thing is, today's 15-year-olds can't get away with that because there's so many forms of social media. Don't get me wrong, I tried the thumbing it in technique. We've all tried it. But if it fails and you've got the opportunity, just say that it happened. And then you never have to think about it until you're 24.
Yeah, and it's a lot easier than dismantling their fundamentally sexist ideas that men gain something from sex and women lose something. But yeah, sure, lying, that'll fix it.
Nice. That's deep. That's the podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Fundamentally dismantling the patriarchy.
Yes. I've been, on a serious note, I have been thinking about it a lot recently. And obviously what happened with Sarah Everard is a reminder. And I try to never go too far away from understanding my privileges. Like the other day, I was walking back to my flat from like a co-working space I go to because I was not coping well with working from home for so long. So the other day I was walking back from there and I realized that somebody had left at the same time. I could hear the clip clap of high heels behind me that followed me all the way to my front door. And it was one of many examples of like, I'm a man being followed by a woman. This does not scare me. In fact, certain types of men might be like, oh, somebody who wears heels knows where I live, depending how creepy they are. But yeah, but it's just these constant reminders that is not a worry for me. But it's a tricky thing, isn't it? That trying to have fun and be out there and date and take these things seriously whilst also not killing the vibe with overtaking it seriously. I don't know if you've had any experience of that. He says, trying to pull it back into comedy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that's very funny. I think in terms of the like lying about sex stuff, there's obviously so many like crazy accepted ideas of what masculinity is. And there's such a perception that, or at least there was, I don't really know what it's like for like 14, 15-year-olds now, because I think there's so much more thoughtful and progressive about ideas like that. But then, back then it was just so much of your cultural value had to do with sexual performance or perceived sexual performance. And it's so ingrained, and it's ingrained everywhere in like all the TV that we get and movies and stuff like that. It all says like it is a function of the man to be incredibly virile, always wanting it, having it a lot. And it's quite confusing. I don't know, I think it's quite confusing for like boys and men growing up, as boys become men, boys to men, trying to fit into that. And then the things that you find yourself doing when you don't is obviously lying and being like, oh, don't worry, I'm just like all of you. And then quietly hating yourself and just getting on with your life. But I imagine maybe, I don't know, I hope it is better now for 14, 15 year olds, because they do seem more, definitely with like mental health and all sort of stuff, they seem so much more open. I'd hope that they're more able to talk about that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I think it is getting better. And with the work I do around mental health, you know, I know that the education is getting better because I'm involved in it. But I think it's
also... Are you
also
a teacher?
No, I campaign for mental health education.
Oh, cool.
So,
oh,
right, yeah, I led the campaign to get it on the curriculum here. But there's still that balance of, okay, things are getting better, but also there's these constant new challenges for them. Like one of my friends who's a teacher, she is honestly quite terrified of the amount that the kids send nudes around. And, you know, not only for them, but also it's a position that the teaching profession doesn't know what to do with. Because if she was shown an image, if a kid just came up and said, "Miss, look what I've been shown," they then have to have an investigation at the school about, because that's an incident, she's viewed child pornography. They're totally still trying to figure out what to do with a lot of this technology and, you know, Snapchat and the kids having phones on them. And, you know, another friend of mine, she worked in a new build school where they specially built it to block out phone signal. It's got like tin in the roof.
Really?
Yeah, especially to stop phone signal. So the kids, they realize they can't confiscate all their phones, but we can block the phone signal.
Oh my God.
Madness.
That's like, I was talking to one of the nurses at work recently, and she's been spying on her son's text messages. So he has his own phone. I think he's like 12, but since he's had it when he's like 8, it's just been left in the kitchen or whatever. And he accepted then that she looked at his text, but she thinks he's forgotten that now. And so he sends he's like messaging girls and stuff. He's not sending like nudes or anything like that, but she's realized he's forgotten that she's checking it. And she's like, "I don't really know what to do." And my advice was like, "Well, I would suggest stop checking it." My advice would be stop reading the messages, but also like have a conversation with them. If you're concerned about, like what you're talking about, like sending nudes to people and the consequence of doing that, probably the healthier pathway is sit them down and discuss it with them instead of being like, "So I was reading your phone," which you don't even know that I do, "and I saw this picture of your 12-year-old penis. Can we talk about this?" Like, that's a bad foundation to talk to your mother.
Yeah, that could be a strong foundation for erectile dysfunction for life, if anything. I can understand her concern.
I don't need this anymore. Thanks, Mum.
But yeah, that is a very intense way of going about it. And I don't know how that ends well. You know, there's going to be something she doesn't want to see on those messages. So that's really tricky. But I think things are getting better. Definitely the conversations are advancing so much, and that's very cool to see. I did a talk at a university not long before lockdown started, and I remember being really surprised by how like grown up and empowered the kids seemed by comparison to when I was their age. And, you know, just little things like, you know, I had like, I'm a bit ginger anyway, but I had like really red hair that I dyed when I was in sixth form, and that was very controversial to the school. I was the first guy to ever have dyed hair in my school, which is weird to me. It's weird
that they kept records of that.
I maybe that says a lot about the school, that they were like, we need to stamp him out.
As far back as the 50s, we have no record of someone dying their hair. We've checked.
It was a very because legitimately, like, so one of the teachers said that to me as a pitch for like why it's unacceptable. That makes no sense.
What color did you dye it?
It was like, okay, it was clearly an artificial red, but I don't know why that was offensive. But the point is, like, certain things like that seemed like a big deal at the time. And then I look out over this room of uni students, and they just all have like distinctive senses of style already, and they seem confident. And I'm like, oh, a bit jealous. You guys seem to have it figured out, but then maybe they're growing up too fast.
That's when it happens, isn't it? People go to uni and then all of that bottled up self-expression that you can't do in secondary school, because secondary school is mostly terrifying and you're just trying to like keep your head down. Then you get to see that thing of going to a new place and reinventing yourself and being like, this is the person I really am. And like with me, I didn't really change at all when I went to university. I just continued being a weird kid, but I carried like the sex lies with me. Like I would still, all the new people I made friends, it wasn't like I would walk up to them and be like, hey, guess what? I had sex with someone when I was 15. But it carries on. It carried on being a thing that I just continued not talking and thinking about in terms of still being like basically terrified of sex. And that's the thing that I think like uni or being 18 or like going out of your immediate circles and whatever trappings of masculinity and anxiety you've got, you have the opportunity to reach out to people. But I don't know, that didn't happen for me. I kind of needed to arrive at that independently.
Hey, it's Austin James. Yes, I'm living with diabetes, but it doesn't have to define me. Thanks to the Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor, I get real-time glucose readings throughout the day. The Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor is small and easy to wear, giving me the freedom to focus on my life as a parent and a musician. Now this is progress. You can get a free sensor at freestylelibre.us.
Offer available for people who qualify. Visit myfreestyle.us to see all terms and conditions. Certain exclusions apply. Data on file, Abbott Diabetes Care, or prescription only. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.
And was that a big part of the fear then, if you don't carry those lies with you, that that will compromise your masculinity?
People would think less of you? Yeah, exactly. It's also, I think when you're in a habit of lying to yourself, and, you know, I should say, like, as the height of privilege in terms of all the axes of male and straight and cis and everything, there's not that much you can really be lying to yourself about or concealing from your identity compared to people who have a much harder time of it, of trying to fit in. But for me, it was just, I just lied to myself. It wasn't until like later in my 20s, I was even able to think or talk about it. Like even talking about it now is only because about a year and a half ago, I started talking about it in stand-up. And then that was a much easier way to talk about any of it because you just focus on the funny bits. And as soon as I started talking about stand-up, I stopped caring. But until that point, I'd never said like, I'm afraid of sex seemed like the most terrifying thing you could ever say to anybody, because you just imagine there's like this idea of the masculine response of like, well, then there's something wrong with you, because that's so, yeah, I don't remember how I went off on that.
I think that's an experience so many people have, and there's no outlet for that. There's no discussion about men having that fear. There's this weird expectation that we're going to know how to do sex before any of us do sex. And then if we don't, we've somehow failed at being male. And it also, I think, encourages this weird thing of we are solely responsible for that, of where does the other person fit into that equation?
Well, it's also really like invalidating of the female experience, because if all you're thinking about, and that's how I was, like as a teenager, like approaching any potential sexual encounter, as we called them back then, approaching anyone, I'm only conceptualizing a bad outcome for me. I'm not thinking at all about like their experiences where like girls would try to initiate sex stuff, and then out of panic I would just like make an excuse or leave or like hang up the phone or like, any number of delaying tactics to not have to confront this thing that I was afraid of. And for me,
I particularly love like hanging up the phone. Was that like a sexual conversation that was starting and you were just like boom?
That was like...
Or was it just the idea of them coming round? They're like, they might get through the phone, hang it up.
Yeah. It was exactly that. It was a girl I think I was dating when I was like 14. And dating just means saying that you're boyfriend, girlfriend, at least it did for us. But she was trying to like... We were talking about going swimming, I think. And then so I tried to escalate it in a safe way of being like, oh, I'm looking forward to seeing you in your bikini. Which was my like, not too sexy, not definitely going to end up with me having to show my penis, but just slightly escalating it. And then she was like, yeah, or I could come over and I could just show you my underwear. And then I was like, okay. And I think I said something like, but what about the swimming? And then hung up pretty soon afterwards. And I had that pattern throughout my teenage years of things heading towards sex and then being like, no thanks. And then even into my, so I didn't lose my virginity ultimately until I was 24, and up until, so through uni as well, and then into my early 20s. And the older you get, the more like terrifying it is, because it's quite normal to be 15 and terrible at sex. Like no one is, it'll be a moment of embarrassment. But the older you get with each year, it becomes more and more of this like high stakes thing. So anyway, I had all of these ways of avoiding sex. And then those people who I did that to, I never at the time thought about, well, they probably feel shit about themselves. They're like, they would see that as a rejection or not being interested or something wrong with them.
Although it's worth me saying, because I have looked into this kind of stuff and trying to, I don't know, get a better context of the world and what other people's dating lives are, because mine is, I'm sure, not representative of anything. And I've been surprised to learn that whilst I hate the concept of virginity, there are studies into it. And what happens is when these are done in a more kind of clinical way, where they collect a lot of information, including details about the people, then the average age tends to be sort of 15, 16 in this country. Mm. But as soon as you anonymize it, then that jumps up to early 20s. And so, absolutely. And so this is the crazy thing, that exactly what you said about finding out later the extent to which friends of yours were lying, that's actually the game that so many people are playing. And I worry about that in terms of what kind of mold does that set in terms of honesty? Why are we then surprised when people get to adulthood and they struggle to communicate about sex? When our society does such a bad job of talking about it, and then people feel the need to lie in order to measure up to ideas that aren't even real. But then that continues. You know, there's like younger people now have access to porn to a whole different rate. You know, so it's like ever evolving. But with your experience, when you think back, was like a specific fear? Was it like fear around not knowing what to do, or were there like any fears specifically?
It was sort of everything, to be honest. Sort of definitely not knowing what to do, definitely being embarrassed, being out. The other thing is because like, I can't remember if I said it after we started recording or before, but so I started having like panic attacks when I was 13 and started being anxious about lots of different things and like drugs and general sense of wanting to control situations. So I think there's part of that that bled into it, of like, that's a situation where you can't, especially like the first time, you can't predict what the outcome's going to be. So you have to go into it with a certain amount of fearlessness. So I think that there was that as well. I think it's just one of those things that's like, when you fixate on it, it becomes a problem because you fixate on it for so long. So because it was a problem at 15 and I decided it was a problem at 15, each year it compounds because time is going past and it's still not getting resolved. So it's all the same fears except now. And then once you start lying, it makes it way worse, because then if my identity at 21 is I'm the person who lost my virginity at 15 and made up lots of side lies of like other people I'd made up I had sex with. Because I had to keep, you know, I didn't tell, none of my friends knew this until I started talking about it in stand-up. Some of my best friends who I've known my entire life had absolutely no idea, because it's just this like lies upon lies upon lies. So when you're 21 and ultimately 24, like there's that whole house of cards of mistruth on top of the original fears that started much younger. So it's this kind of, I'm really aware this isn't very funny.
Don't worry, it's interesting and it's real. You know, I think whenever we get onto something in the podcast where it's a common experience, but one that isn't talked about, I'm always up for talking about that. And if people are relating to this, then what was the thing that got you to the point of talking about it? Like, I know you said comedy was the vehicle for getting used to talking about it and owning this, but was there something that brought that decision of this is okay to talk on?
I think so. I talked in therapy about it and I was so ashamed of it. I mean, I started therapy properly, I think when I was 25 or 26, and I didn't talk for a year of therapy. I didn't even mention it because I was so like, even once I'd lost it, I was still ashamed of that. That was the age at which I'd lost it. And even though like, so I lost it and then got into like a long-term 2.5-3 year relationship. And then now I'm in another 3-year relationship. She loves it when I describe it as another 3-year relationship. That's that's how we describe it. Anyway, so I told my therapist after about a year, and then I told my current girlfriend, I told very early on in our relationship. And she was the first person after my therapist I talked about general sexual anxiety and the age at which I lost it. And then I don't really know. I think I was just in stand-up, I was just becoming more wanting to talk about myself, rather than like initially when I started doing it, I was just doing absurd, not real stuff. And I just felt like it was a real opportunity. Actually, it was because, so she's a comic as well. And she talks, she's, since she started, talked a lot about hang-ups and not exclusively, but she's talked about the most embarrassing moments of her life. And then through that, made them really funny and
reclaimed them.
Yeah, exactly. Reclaimed it. So I'd kind of seen that as a bit of a role model. And I thought about doing that. And then I just gently started talking about it. And then as soon as I did, I was just like, it was like a huge, huge weight was lifted off my shoulders. Like just all this shame and secrecy around it. And I do have jokes about it. I'm not doing them here. But it was really fun starting to talk about the stuff that feels disgusting and then having people laugh about it. And as soon as people laugh about it, and as soon as you start talking about it, obviously that's like the big thing with mental health, is as soon as you start talking about the things that are like haunting you or troubling you, it gets 1 million times easier, because then someone will be like, oh yeah, I have the same thing. Or people will mostly just be like, that's not a big deal, no one cares. Like, so yeah, it was mostly that. And I think just feeling all right about, like, I don't worry about the things that I worried about at 15 in terms of like sexual anxieties of how's it going to go and all that sort of stuff. You obviously, once you do it and then start doing it, you realize it's all basically unfounded. It's all basically in fear. And being good at sex doesn't actually have anything to do with, at least in my experience, all the archetypical things that you think make you fantastic at sex, like lasting for 10 hours and having a like porn star penis. That's basically got nothing to do with it. It's mostly about connection and communication and all that sort of stuff. And so through all of that, yeah.
And some of that, I would assume, is pretty disappointing for women as well, that just because you have experience doesn't mean you're good at it. Like, that's so oversimplified as well. There are plenty of people that live a whole life not listening to their partners, and guess what? Their partners don't enjoy it as much.
Yeah, yeah. On the first date we went on, I basically, because we didn't know we were going to date each other, we thought we were just going on like a friendly, like just going to Pizza Express friend date. We ended up just like sharing all of stuff about ourselves, like all the stuff we hated about ourselves. And I said all the sex anxiety stuff, but feeling safe, because I was like, I'm never going to have sex with you, so I can tell you all this stuff, which was the ultimate bait and switch. And I think she knew that. I think that was the trick. She was like, but I think you would probably be good, just because guys who've had loads and loads of sex with loads of different people, that doesn't mean they're going to be really good at it. If anything, that stands a greater possibility that it's more important to have more sex than it is to have good communicative sex.
Yeah, very true. And I realize I've not given you any points yet. So points for that.
Ding, 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 ding. You gave me points for a point that my girlfriend made. So I'm actually furious about that. That means nothing to me.
Okay, well, you can tell her afterwards. She's achieved something today. Great. But no, I think that's true. And it's funny what you said about going on that and the things you talked about that you wouldn't have talked about on a date. I do wonder that sometimes, how many of us would be better on a first date if we didn't have those stakes, you know, like how much we can get into our head and analyze it. And I don't know if I do a good job of that or not, because I get told by people that I'm quite intense. And so I try and sort of taper that out and not ask all the questions I might want to ask and end up interviewing someone I'm on a date with. Because if podcasting does one thing to you, it doesn't make you less intense, put it that way. And and so I try and counteract that. But then maybe there's an argument that people just ask me out as a friend and they might get a more low-key version of me anyway with a lot less effort.
I think that's better if you can. I don't really know how you set that up, because you have to go into it knowing that you want to have a relationship with one of your friends. So you have to pick a friend and then both of you agree you don't want a relationship and then trick yourself into revealing yourselves for who you really are. And then suddenly, like we spent maybe 2 weeks, like just constantly saying to each other, like, but this isn't a date. We're not dating. Like this. And then maybe it was about 2 weeks after that where she was coming to like my family Christmas and I was introducing her to everybody. Like, this is my new girlfriend. It's very serious.
I love that. But you know what? As elaborate as that may sound, I do often feel like it would make more sense if we go through friendship first. Mm. And I have realized a pattern of mine is that sometimes I go for people that feel like lower stakes, and that's why sometimes I end up in relationships where those people don't necessarily seem as good a match to me as friends of mine, and yet this is the person I'm dating. And you know, I think a part of that comes from like certain things around, you know, feeling safe in a relationship and feeling like I know what I'm doing there. And so particularly when I was younger, I guess my equivalent of what you've been describing was a lot of the time I would chase after somebody and it maybe wouldn't work out, or I'd get rejected or whatever. And then somehow in my young brain, I don't think I was doing this logically, but I can see in hindsight that I would often counteract that then with going out with somebody who such and such a friend had said fancied me. And then I was like, oh, this person wasn't on my radar. I was chasing after this other person, but they're cute as well. Let's see how this goes. And this kind of switching between things that feel far too high stakes and I get my heart broken, and then things that feel lower stakes and I get kind of confused by, should I be with you? I'm almost kind of jumping on it and then figuring out later.
Yeah. There's nothing more appealing than someone who's already confirmed they're into you. Like, there's nothing more like than somebody saying like, oh, that person thinks whatever, and you can go into it with that, like, whatever that gross, like, monkey status brain we have that needs to feel important can go into it being like, I'm safe here because I'm not the one who initiated this, and I know I can't be, what's the word, I'm not gonna have my heart broken because I'm the one going into it with an elevated position. But it's so hard because so much of it is, no matter what your relationship is, so much of it is just a status battle of who's where, even if it doesn't feel consciously like that.
And sadly, in experience, it doesn't even work anyway, because, of course, you get into a relationship with somebody, you get more attached to them, and the stakes rise. So luckily, a strategy I grew out of, because it did not work.
I think the strategy you should adopt is just fuck your friends. So just start by all of your like closest friends who you care the most about but could never imagine them sexually. Start approaching them for sexual relationships, and then hopefully one of them will develop into a very deep and meaningful relationship. And then you'll have no other friends once you're done because you've ruined them all. So then your new partner won't ever need to be jealous because they'll just be like, this dude has no friends because he has sex with them all.
I don't know. Do friendless males make the most appealing partners? I don't know. I think there could be a lot of emotional reliance to take on.
It's healthy. People like that. People like being relied on.
I love that you're joking, but also I feel kind of called out because I definitely am someone that's had a lot of like ambiguous things going on with friends. And
I
very much fall into those. I not in a bad way, like I enjoy it, and generally I can hack it. I think I survive better in the vagueness than a lot of people.
Really?
Yeah, but then I also have quite an avoidant attachment style, so something that doesn't threaten my sense of independence but is still somebody I'm close to and have a consistency with. That appeals to me. So yeah, avoidant people tend to need someone that's going to lock them down.
Yeah, but it's so hard because you want to have it both ways. You're like, you don't want the responsibility, but you want the familiarity and the comfort.
I guess maybe that's my equivalent to what you've talked about with sex, is feeling like I'm not good at relationships in a more general sense. And if I'm really honest, I still feel that way. You know, I think
you in a relationship?
I'm not. I'm single, and I think I'm very good at being single. If I do say so myself, as the person
does
dating
myself.
Does
that mean you man fucking? Is that what you mean, you man fucking?
in a lockdown. No, I mean, I also don't have a very high sex drive, and I never really thought about it too much. But as I've got older, I've realized that. Just, I guess I didn't care about it as much as some people. And it's only as I've got older, I'm like, ooh, I comparatively have a lesser sex drive. And I think for a lot of men, that would maybe be a threat to their identity.
That's a really taboo thing as well, even to say. I think if people were more honest about it, that's the thing. When I started talking about the sex stuff, I had multiple dudes say that to me about, I mean, people who lost their virginity late and lied about it, but also the sex drive thing. I've just been like, to say that you have a lower or comparatively lower sex drive has the stigma associated with it. And it's so stupid because it's that's what it is.
Yeah,
there is no normal.
Like, I still want it, but it's just not as forward a focus for me, I've realized, as for a lot of guys. And I think it makes for an easier life. And hopefully it makes me more open. You know, like if I ever hear about experiences of people who are asexual, so many people I know that, like, they could never. Like, I think I probably could date somebody that was asexual. You know, maybe in a polyamorous way might be the compromise or something like that. But I think I could probably figure out that in monogamy with a bit of time. I don't know. Like, who knows? Maybe we'll find out through the course of the podcast. But That's
very interesting. I've never talked to somebody who's in a asexual relationship, but I'd be very curious to hear what it was like. So you have to get in one, and then you can tell me.
I'll do the research for you. Okay, that's my new calling in life. I tell you what, though, maybe part of the reason why it's not taboo for me is that because I date people of all genders, that tends to come with the stereotype that I'm dating everybody of all genders. So I don't know, maybe that's something where people are like, no, you having a low sex drive, that doesn't fit, I won't believe it. It's a complicated one. Hey, masculinity, isn't it fun? Nobody wins.
No, someone must be winning. I feel like someone must be winning.
I mean, Boris, he's got so many kids.
He's got a lot of kids. But what if he hates fucking? What if Boris Johnson is like super low sex drive and just forces himself every single time? But he'll never admit that he doesn't want to have sex because it would affect his masculinity. So he just forces himself through all of these like sexual ordeals because he thinks that his like Bullingdon mates are going to find out that he didn't want to have sex. And he'll be like, Boris, you're out.
And yet he still seems to be winning in that situation because he has a lot of women looking after his kids for him. And he has one child who's actively suing him to admit that he's her father. So
that's the dream. I want to be so prolific sexually that I'm being sued. I just want to get sued. That's how you know you've had a good one night stand, is when you're getting sued for it. I have to imagine.
Okay, I think for the good of the nation, maybe you need to stay in this relationship. Tell me, how is it going?
Yeah, it's really good. What are we, 3 years? Two and a half years. Maybe three and a half years. It's going good, and I know exactly how long it's been going on. I think it's just because COVID has completely distorted all sense of time. So it could have been 10 years, it could have been a month. It's really good. It's really good. I like it. We live together. We argue a good amount, I think.
What's a good amount to you?
Like, I don't know, once a month, maybe? Once a month for an argument, but maybe more often than that for flare-ups. Because I'm British, so I'm very repressed. She's Dutch, so she's pretty direct and open about stuff. So for her, it's not difficult to express her feelings. For me, it usually takes a fight. Like, we have to reach a peak argument of, like, disagreement.
And then you'll emote. That's what it is.
And then I'll reluctantly emote, begrudgingly, like a small amount of blood will eke out of the stone and it'll just be a single tear. And I'll wipe it down my brow and say, you win. Are you happy now? Are you happy now? I'm a person. But our arguments are stupid, like, but actually really good. I really like arguing because I like the bit after the anger where you just learn stuff about yourself and you're like, oh yeah, that was really, when you both kind of admitted you've done something wrong, those are the best ones. I don't like the ones where I have to admit that I've 100% done something wrong. I'll usually try and get at least 1% commitment that we had a shared responsibility, even though a lot of time, we had an argument a couple of weeks ago because, and it was so stupid. We watched The Post with Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep. And afterwards, I was like, I didn't really think that Tom Hanks gave a good performance in that movie. And she, like, disagreed with me. And she disagreed with me in a way that I went to the toilet and I was standing there and I was genuinely furious. I was like, she doesn't respect my opinions. She just ignored completely what I said about Tom Hanks. And she didn't respond to it. And she just said her opinion. She thinks she's always right. She thinks she's better than me. And then as I was running through all these like catastrophizing arguments, I was just like, oh, this is really stupid. And I just went out to her it was really tense after we disagreed about this thing. I was like, I don't know why I'm so upset about this Tom Hanks thing. And it's all my own stuff of like projecting feeling insecure and feeling stupid and feeling like people don't listen to me. That was when I gave her 100%. I did not think it was her fault.
But that's good.
She had a different opinion.
I like that though, because that is growth, I can say, because you could have gone the lying route with that. You could have been like, oh shit, when I go through this stuff in my head, it doesn't hold up. Quick, let me find something else to be angry at.
Yeah. I do that as well. You do that. You take a step back and you'll be like, okay, I'm not going to win this argument, but maybe we can bring in some broader themes and I can at least get a, we'll both try harder next time. But it's really difficult. Like, I'm ridiculously stubborn and hate admitting when I'm wrong. But that's why I love the part of the argument. When I find myself admitting I'm wrong and I believe it, it's just this enormous cathartic weight of like, it's that big weight being lifted off your shoulders of like, oh, thank God I don't have to be right. Like being right is exhausting and I don't want to be right. But for some reason, it just takes such a sledgehammer to be like, I guess I don't have that strong an opinion about Tom Hanks movies. I guess my ability to judge Tom Hanks' acting is actually not central to my personality and I don't really need it to be.
Well, we've all learned something there. Should we get on to our rules of the game?
Sure.
So do you have something in mind that you like to live by with dating or relationships?
Rules of the game.
Other than having quite a solid count on how frequently you're arguing. I appreciate that.
I don't know. Be wrong. Just be wrong all the time. Don't think it's important that you're like good. Don't think that you have to actually be anything good. Don't think you have to be like the mad shagger and that will impress people. Don't think you have to be right all the time. Just accept that you're a piece of shit. Go into every encounter accepting that you're a piece of shit. That's the rule. I didn't think that there was a rule of the game, but I've decided that is the rule of the game. You're a piece of shit and accept that from the jump.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. So that means I need not worry about being bad at relationships anymore. I just accept that I'm a piece of shit, move on, yep. And still accept somebody to be a good partner to me. Ooh.
Yeah, and really judge them for what standard they're at. So you're fine, but they've got a bit of work to do.
Thank you for explaining the patriarchy.
You're welcome.
I haven't tried it nearly enough. Maybe that's where I'm going wrong. All right, well, I like that. I like that that's suitably pointed in a fun way. I have one maybe similar to that, in that as a single person who spent most of his adult life single, and I don't mind it as much as a lot of people think I should, my rule of the game would be stop asking why I'm single, unless you want me to ask you why you're still married. I have noticed a strong correlation between people that are most insistent on finding out why I'm still single are often the people that are in unhappy relationships themselves. And somehow me getting into one is a way to fix that, as opposed to what's actually going on in their life. I don't know if you've come across this.
I think everyone thinks that their way of doing things is the right way of doing things. So people in relationships are like, get in a relationship. And people who are single are like, why aren't you also single? But I'm also feel like you've blindsided me with how pithy your rule of the game was. Like that was like a really clean one-liner. I feel like you can deliver that really nicely. Whereas I hadn't planned something, so I went off on this rambling tear.
I love it. I'll let you into
change tack several times throughout. I've made several really track together, and they weren't really connected to anything I've said anywhere else in this podcast. Whereas yours was like a neat little, and I even saw you looking at notes. So I'm pretty sure you had that cocked and ready to go.
All right, so you've caught me. But no, I do like your approach in that if you give a series of contradictory statements, then you can't get in trouble for them because they don't make enough sense for people to be offended. I have started doing this thing where I have one written down because usually I make them up at the time, and sometimes that takes longer than other times. So I have to stall. So now I have one written down as like a backup one. And so that seemed to link to yours.
Preparation is key. As a podcaster, you gotta come in with some prep. You gotta come in prepped.
Good pun dividends. About STDs you didn't realise you were making.
I didn't realise that. See, there's my sexual inexperience. You've caught me, Bobby.
Did you know PrEP was a drug?
Isn't it? No, not really. Oh, isn't it the precautionary one?
Yeah, against HIV/AIDS. Mm-hmm. That's the one.
Yeah. I knew about that.
Sure he did. Cool. All right, so we will wrap up there. Thank you so much for being a wonderful guest.
Thanks, Bobby. Bye.
Thank you for listening. For more content, including extended ad-free episodes, you can join our Patreon, linked in the episode description. Our show is edited and produced by Pete Murta, with music by the brilliant Tessa Violet. Speak to you next Friday.
Hey, it's Austin James. Yes, I'm living with diabetes, but it doesn't have to define me. Thanks to the Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor, I get real-time glucose readings throughout the day. The Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor is small and easy to wear, giving me the freedom to focus on my life as a parent and a musician. Now this is progress. You can get a free sensor at freestylelibre.us.
Offer available for people who qualify. Visit myfreestyle.us to see all terms and conditions. Certain exclusions apply. Data on file, Abbott Diabetes Care, or prescription only. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.